from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Scotland stays, Congress says yes to money for Syrian rebels, Ebola mounts, the NFL squirms. In Scotland, a no vote on independence. 55% said no. Better Together campaign leader Alistair Darling was relieved.
Today is a momentous result for Scotland and also for the United Kingdom as a whole. Yes!
As Congress voted on funding, Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey raised the specter of U.S. troops on the ground.
If there are threats to the United States, then I, of course, would go back to the president and make a recommendation that may include the use of U.S. military ground forces.
And one bad story after another in the NFL. Ray Rice, Adrian Peterson, Jonathan Dwyer, ESPN's Hannah Storm, and many others lashed into the league.
I spent this week answering seemingly impossible questions about the league's biggest stars. Mom, why did he do that? Why is he in jail? Why didn't he get fired?
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, James Kitfield of National Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? Were you rooting for scot-free for Syrian rebel funding? And what is up with the NFL? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Plenty to talk about there. Nancy Cordes, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's always great to be with you.
Really wonderful to have you. James Kitfield is with us from Washington, contributing editor at National Journal, contributor at Defense One, senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. James Kitfield, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Tom. Good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and James.
Let's go right to Scotland, if we may. A no vote. After all the back and forth and nobody knew and it looked like it might go, it will not. 55% of voters, big turnout, saying no. Here's one of the no votes, speaking with the BBC, a woman from Aberdeen, saying she's happy the country voted no.
No, I never wavered. I was no throughout. I felt that we were too weak to stand alone and that quite happy to be a united country.
Never wavered, but many looked elsewhere. London was thrilled. Here's the Prime Minister, British David Cameron, celebrating Scotland's vote to reject independence and stay in. He said he'll deliver on promises made to Scotland for new powers there.
The people of Scotland have spoken, and it is a clear result. They have kept our country of four nations together. And like millions of other people, I am delighted.
Yes, he's delighted. Many in Scotland who voted the other way are not. Here's one in Glasgow.
Actually, I'm really disappointed about it. I genuinely thought it was going to be a yeah, but because it was a no, it's like, I hope that we get more powers and stuff like that, and I hope that stuff happens now that we have, because I think we dealt with it really well as a country.
James Kitfield, here we are, people talking in the days and weeks leading up to this election about, could we still have a Union Jack? Would there still be a United Kingdom? And for that matter, would we see this as the first sort of domino of lots of little pieces of countries pulling away? What do you take ultimately, James, from Scotland's decision to stay in the United Kingdom?
Well, I think from the American point of view, it's a very, very good thing. You know, Britain is our go-to number one ally in the world whenever we face a crisis. And we always have considered it, you know, greater than the sum of its four parts. Recall that its strategic nuclear fleet of Trident submarines is in Scotland. So from American perspective, I think this is good on two levels. From a strategic level, as an ally, Britain is stronger, as I said. And also this balkanization of countries breaking up along ethnic lines, we've seen that lead to trouble any number of places. I think we feel much better in an international system of nation states that reconcile these ethnic differences internally. I think that's a very useful thing, and I think that we're breathing a sigh of relief in Washington.
Nancy Cordes, were the halls of the U.S. Congress attuned into this? Were people watching, wondering what might this be the beginning of? Do you have any sense of a congressional emotional or strategic response?
Oh, absolutely. People were paying attention for all of the reasons that James just mentioned. In fact, the White House has already put out a statement that essentially amounts to a big sigh of relief, saying we welcome the result of yesterday's referendum. We congratulate the people of Scotland for their full and energetic exercise of democracy. So essentially saying, you know, we're glad you got this off your chest, but we're also really glad that you're going to stay a member of the UK.
Jack Beattie, you know that our engineer here at On Point, on the other side of the glass from me right now, James Roth, Scottish to the bone, yes, was watching this very, very closely, but he wasn't wearing a kilt all week. Were you, Jack? Which way were you rooting here? Did you care?
I did care. I wanted it just on sentimental grounds to stay together. But, you know, there is a latent lesson here for America about our form of government. All my life, I've heard of the supposed advantages of unitary parliamentary government. One of the disadvantages is you can be completely shut out regionally. Mm-hmm. In the 2010 general election, the most recent one, the Tories got one seat north of the Clyde, one to 41 Labour.
Yeah.
They have been shut out. Now, divided government produces policy paralysis. We've seen that in Washington. But it does mitigate sectional political alienation of the kind we saw rampant in Scotland recently. And indeed, the most potent national slogan, according to the Financial Times, was no more Tory governments ever. That's the way people feel up there. And the political system of first past the post, all unitary parliamentary government, is going to keep that grievance around for a long time.
I mean, there were a few minutes there where people wondered, what's next, Texas, Vermont? Scotland didn't like the conservative Tory politics and policies coming out of London, and it was a close thing here. They very nearly said, we don't like them so much, we want to do things our way. Cheryl in Des Moines, Iowa is calling. Hi, Cheryl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm relieved that the vote turned out the way it did. I think that it's a good thing that the vote was taken because the people of Scotland, and I'm always for the people of Scotland, need the powers that they're going to be granted and because of this threat to dissolve themselves from the EU. But I think I like stability in government. I don't like turmoil. I like the fact that NATO is going to be preserved, the EU is going to be preserved, that we have a strong ally, and that there's not going to be quite as much confusion.
Stability takes the day here, but the Scots were willing to use all that leverage, eyeball to eyeball with London, and it has won them, or promises of, more autonomy. One more on this one. Josh in Montreal in Canada. Josh, thank you for calling.
Yes, hello, Tom. It's a wonderful day for, I think, anyone who's a federalist in Canada. Our country will remain a federation where Quebec, which has been threatening to separate for decades, will probably somehow accommodate to the fact that there are other provinces in the federation. And although it's a distinct society, from now on, I think the Scottish result will tamper, if not snuff out the fervor of the separatists to have their own independent nation. So I say bravo to the Scots, but also God bless the Queen.
All right. Here it comes from Canada. Canada holds, as Scotland holds, maybe, and maybe a little slowdown in the move to separate, to cut away, to cut out, though there are still plenty of those efforts and a lot of that dynamic in the world today. Talk about separation. We saw a little bit within the administration. I want to ask everybody about this. We had, of course, President Obama went down to U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida. And this was midweek after his top general, Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, had been before Congress. But the president felt, obliged or eager to go down and sort of rally the troops around his strategy on ISIS and to reassert that he is not going to put boots on the ground.
The American forces that have been deployed to Iraq do not and will not have a combat mission. They will support Iraqi forces on the ground as they fight for their own country against these terrorists. As your commander-in-chief, I will not commit you and the rest of our armed forces to fighting another ground war in Iraq.
President Obama at CENTCOM. Kind of a funny moment there where a commander-in-chief is saying, I will not send you to battle. But just the day before, Tuesday, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee in Washington, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, general, spoke about the strategy there and said, well, he could imagine a situation where he would advise the president to bring in U.S. combat troops.
Right now, the airmen, as the ranking member mentioned, are very much in a combat role. The folks on the ground are in a very much a combat advisory role. They are not participating in direct combat. There is no intention for them to do so. I've mentioned, though, that if I found that circumstance evolving, that I would, of course, change my recommendation.
James Kitfield, what is General Dempsey telegraphing to us here?
It's really the unfortunately the President Obama's sort of tendency in these issues of committing military force to split the difference has got him into a semantics battle that is very unhelpful. And what Dempsey is saying is don't tie our hands with being too specific, you know, about exactly how many boots on the ground. It's the mission that's important.
But is there a behind the scenes difference of opinion? Is Dempsey telegraphing he wishes that we were putting boots on now?
Well, we are putting boots on now. We have 1,600 boots on the ground, and I'll go on out on a limb on our prediction. We're going to have many, many more before this is over.
No combat boots, the president says. All advisors, all away from the field.
Well, this is the semantics argument. Is someone who is embedded with Iraqi forces who are the frontline forces but is calling an American air power for them, a special forces guy, is he in combat? I mean, I don't know. You can make your own decision. He might get killed, but he's not in the front line. So it's not major ground combat units, but the military, to be effective with our air power, needs to have U.S. boots, you know, on the ground.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Scotland stays in. Congress greenlights money for Syrian rebels. Ebola mounts. NFL woes. Nancy Cordes is with us from CBS News. Congressional correspondent there, James Kitfield from National Journal. Jack Beatty's here. There's a lot I want to get into here, but first, Nancy, I want to come to you on Congress. We had a big spending bill. Funding for Syrian moderates was part of it. This was no slam dunk, and we may see more dissent down the road. But here was California Republican Kevin McCarthy, House Majority Leader, talking Wednesday before the vote to approve the plan to train and equip moderate Syrian rebels. Said he would vote in favor of the strategy, but also stressed he had deep concerns that the program would require oversight.
I'm not convinced this train and equip effort will change the balance of power on the ground anytime soon. And I believe this approach comes with great risks. I am also concerned that airstrikes alone will be insufficient to meet the international threat posed by these terrorists. Congress must maintain a central role. We must conduct oversight to ensure this program is managed effectively.
Nancy Cordes, give us a sense of the conversation in Congress around signing off on this money for Syrian rebels. And if you would, speak to this issue of boots on the ground and what it means to senators and representatives. Do they think it means special forces out spotting airstrikes in the field near the front lines?
Well, on the first part of your question, I have to say this was one of the most interesting and thoughtful debates I've seen in Congress in quite some time. As you heard from Congressman McCarthy, even those who supported this plan had real reservations, real concerns. So no one was incredibly gung-ho one way or the other. Those who oppose the plan say, how do we know that these rebels really are moderates? How do we know that down the line they won't turn our weapons against us or sell those weapons to ISIS? Will it really make a difference if we train 5,000 rebels in Syria? Can that really turn the tide? And how long is it going to take them to actually train up and become true fighters that can make a difference? On the other hand, you had supporters of the plan saying, look, we don't have any great options here. This is the best of a bunch of bad options. The U.S. has spent the past year really vetting these rebels. We now have a much better sense of who our friends are and who our enemies are. And the 5,000 is just the beginning. We think that if we train between these guys that eventually more Syrians will join the fight. So, you know, it was really, really interesting. And at the end of the day in the House, I was somewhat surprised by the large number of members who voted no. Almost half of Democrats, one third of Republicans. It passed much, much more overwhelmingly in the Senate, only about 20 voting no. But on the second question that you asked, which was about
boots on the ground.
You know, I think a lot of members of Congress have the same question you have. And as they weigh whether to support the president's plan or not, a lot of them ask this week, what does he mean? Are we committing ground troops? Are we not committing ground troops? Is this all just semantics? And, you know, can we really know if anyone says no ground troops right now that it's not going to change down the road? So these are the kinds of questions that the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense got multiple times on Capitol Hill this week as they testified in front of committees in both the House and the Senate. And I think there are still a lot of open questions that need to be answered before the Senate and possibly the House take up a broader authorization package, possibly in December, about whether to grant the president authority to strike ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
Jack, I did not perceive this as quite this semantic as James Kitfield is presenting it today. As Nancy says, Congress is wondering. It seemed like a pretty bright line this president was drawing. But if you've got advisors who are out there in a war-fighting capacity, in what sense are they not combat forces?
Yes, only in some semantic sense. And when the administration gets into that kind of verbal torture, it creates all kinds of credibility problems. You know, 68% of the American people, according to a Wall Street Journal poll, don't have confidence that the United States will achieve the goals the president outlined. The chief goal is, quote, to ultimately destroy ISIL. Now, what's the track record on insurgencies? Well, you know, the foreign policy looks at this and they point to President Bush in 2006. We will defeat the Taliban. We put over 100,000 troops into Afghanistan. The Taliban today, 20,000 to 60,000 fighters, apparently. They have a shadow government, according to one source, in all 34 Afghan provinces, except Kabul. So that's not an encouraging, that's a support for the kind of skepticism the people have. But even more, Rear Admiral Kirby, the Pentagon spokesperson, he says our goal is to, quote, destroy their ideology. Now think of that, destroy their ideology. And according to Seth Jones at the RAND Corporation, there's been a 60% increase in the number of people drawn to Islamic radicalism in the last 4 years. Not exactly a resounding victory for defeating an ideology.
I've got lots of questions. So do our listeners. Luke in New York, Potsdam, New York. Luke, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. How can we pass a bill to arm Eastern militants yet again, but we've never had a moment self-reflective enough to realize that ISIS is using American weapons from the Iraq War? How can we pass this bill and then not pass a bill for equal pay for women? I'm sorry if that was a tangent, but I'm just completely perplexed by what's going on here.
Let me just pick up that first half of it, James Kitfield, with you. I mean, at this point, thanks, Luke, we've got General Dempsey saying, I'm just looking at a story out today, saying it may take 1 year to train Syrian rebels. Now, we've got this ISIS threat that's supposed to be so significant. Yes, there are plenty of airstrikes already, and even the French now in on those airstrikes. They're first in northeast Iraq. But a year to train these rebels? And then we're only talking 5,000. We're told lately that ISIS already has 30,000 members. Is this adding up, James?
Well, I think it does add up, but it adds up to, as Jack said, a lot of very bad options and trying to pick the best strategy to realize your goal of first degrading and hopefully defeating in terms of a sort of terrorist army that can threaten a nation state like Iraq. I think that would be a goal that is conceivable. The Syrian rebel part of that is only a small part. I would keep our eyes focused on Iraq. And it gets back to this issue of boots on the ground. You know, what we've done so far is hit sort of individual targets of ISIS that were threatening villages and Kurdish cities in northern Iraq. You know, what Dempsey said was, if we are going to help the Iraqis go on the offensive and retake major cities like Mosul, when you have a civilian population, you have, you know, block by block fighting, if you don't have pretty good granularity on the ground about where you're dropping those bombs, you're going to end up killing a lot of civilians. So he said, in that case, I might call for having spotters much closer to the forward edge of battle. I mean, that's what the military is saying, is if we're serious about defeating these guys, we're going to, Iraq's going to be the main effort, and we're going to have to, you know, be the air power for the Iraqi forces and Peshmerga forces, Kurdish forces.
But is the White House on board with that, James? Are they saying, oh, yeah, that's what we mean, spotters out by the front lines?
You know, I think that the Deputy National Security Advisor said basically that, you know, it, we'll take it in a case by case basis. But the military is going to be pressing for being effective. They don't want to marry, you know, they don't want ISIS to win this thing. And so they want to be as effective as possible. And that means, sort of calibrating the risk factor with how effective you can be. And as we, you know, have already seen, the CENTCOM commander requested that they embed forward air controllers in retaking the Mosul Dam. The president and the White House said, nix that proposal. But if that's easy pickings compared to retaking a major city like Mosul, and there's going to be this tension between the White House that wants to have quote unquote no boots on the ground and the military that's focused on succeeding at the mission, which is to degrade and destroy ISIL.
I just wonder if the country's being rallied honestly, openly to the effort. Jill in New York, Hamburg, New York. Jill, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thank you, Tom. I think that you're arguing a false argument. We already have special forces on the ground. We already have efforts to help the Syrian rebels. And we're just going to enhance this with what we're doing now. I think what the president is saying is there will be no regular forces, boots on the ground. Thank you.
Jill, I appreciate your call. Maybe, Jack, but you think at a moment like this, you'd kind of want clarity, and I'm not sure we've got clarity. I mean, people have said from the beginning, maybe that's what we'll do, but I don't hear the president quite saying that to the country, Jack.
No, it's almost as if he's acting as if this is his first term and he's afraid of, you know, problems with the base of his party. This isn't his first term. He doesn't have to make extravagant claims or things he can't back up. So it is very peculiar that they've put themselves this early into this kind of semantic box, creating what is, I think, going to be rampant skepticism as we go forward.
I want to ask about Syria in this. James, you're talking about Iraq. This week, it was very interesting. We had Iran's foreign minister in the United States for United Nations meetings. This is Foreign Minister Javad Zarif. And he talked in some interesting interviews with NPR's Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep there. And here he's talking about the whole U.S. approach. This is Iran's foreign affairs minister saying the U.S. ought to just reach an accommodation with Syrian President Assad.
I think President Obama needs to reach an accommodation with reality. That's what we need. I mean, we don't want to impose people on anybody. We need to deal with realities.
Okay. Now, Syria and Assad, those are Iran's allies. Nancy Cordes, do you get a sense in Washington, in Congress, that there's some opening here to dealing with Assad, that we have to deal with Assad if we're going to? I mean, many are saying, you think you're going to arm these rebels and the first thing they're going to go after is ISIS? No, they want Assad out. How do we deal with that?
There is absolutely no appetite for dealing with Assad whatsoever on Capitol Hill or at the White House. Everyone is still in agreement that Assad needs to go, that his legitimacy is completely gone, but that our first priority is ISIS. So he's not seen as a realistic partner in any way. That is one of the concerns that was raised this week, was that if you arm these moderate rebels whose main goal and whose reason for being is to topple the Assad government, how do we know that they're going to take the fight to ISIS? And those who have spoken with them extensively, who testified this week, including Ambassador Ford, said at this point, it is in their interest to go after ISIS because, first of all, ISIS has slaughtered their ranks just like they have slaughtered others. And second of all, they they can't really take the fight to Assad as long as ISIS exists and has as much power as it does. So that is the argument for arming the rebels, despite the fact that their number one goal is to topple Assad. But, you know, Congress loses patience, as you know, very quickly, loses focus very quickly. And so the White House does run the risk, the president does run the risk of being a little cute here. If he's parsing things too carefully and sometimes saying we want to degrade them and sometimes saying we want to destroy them and sometimes saying no boots on the ground, well, maybe boots on the ground, you know, members of Congress are going to start to get frustrated that there is no clear mission, no clear goal. And when that happens, just like we saw a year ago when the president asked Congress for authority to strike Assad, when members felt that there wasn't a clear goal, a clear end game, they backed away and he didn't get support. And even though most members of Congress right now say that something needs to be done about ISIS, it's very possible that over the next few months, they could change their mind. So they need to be hearing a very, very clear strategy and goal from the White House.
The whole issue comes back in December. I want to turn, if I may, to Ebola, though this does not move entirely away this week from the U.S. military. Exponential increase in the numbers of Ebola cases, and we're told there. Sierra Leone in lockdown. Here's the BBC's correspondent there talking about what's going on to try and stop Ebola from spreading in that one country. Drastic measures.
Some 6 million Sierra Leoneans are bracing up for an unprecedented three-day lockdown, which will see them stay at home from the 19th to the 21st of September. The authorities say the measure is necessary to stem the spread of the Ebola virus, which has affected 13 of the country's 14 districts. Nearly 30,000 young volunteers have been recruited to move from door to door throughout the country to educate people about the Ebola virus.
A whole country in lockdown. And back in the United States, back at CENTCOM Central Command in Tampa, the President of the United States saying, we're going to have U.S. troops going to help.
I announced a major boost to our response. We're establishing a military command center in Liberia at the request of their government to support civilian efforts across the region.
And then speaking directly to those troops, who may have mixed feelings about going to work on Ebola.
To all the servicemen and women here and around the world, we ask a lot of you. And any mission involves risk. And any mission separates you from your families. And sending our service members into harm's way is not a decision I ever take lightly. It is the hardest decision I make as president. Nothing else comes close.
James Kitfield, is there a precedent for this? The U.S. military being deployed abroad in not insignificant numbers to fight an outbreak of disease?
You know, I can't think of specifically a case where, this level of effort was launched to fight an outbreak of disease. But there, you know, the disaster response ability of the U.S. military is tested all the time, whether that's tsunamis or earthquakes around the world or in Haiti or in this case, an outbreak that could threaten hundreds of thousands of people. So, you know, I applaud the president for taking the step. But we are in an uncharted territory with this Ebola outbreak. Goes to show you once again that, you know, if the United States doesn't take a leadership role and do these things, they just don't get done. And you could have hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of people at risk in Africa. So
as many as
there's no one else to do it.
As many as 3,000 U.S. troops may be headed out. We had already offered a 25-bed portable hospital. That looked pretty puny compared to the outbreak there. Now they're talking about the U.S. military constructing as many as 17 Ebola treatment centers in the region, maybe 1,700 treatment beds. Nancy Cordes, this is looks like new territory to me. And unlike the aftermath of a tsunami, you can go to help fight Ebola and die yourself from Ebola.
Right. And it's one of the things you have to go big if you're going to do it, as far as the U.S. is concerned, because if even one or two cases make it over here, you have no idea what could happen. And so I think that the White House is taking a very forward-looking role. They're being very preventative. And as of right now, they've got the support of Congress. People are very, very afraid of this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, China's e-commerce giant Alibaba goes public, valued at $168 billion, more than eBay, Twitter, and LinkedIn combined. Yahoo has a big stake in the company, and former Yahoo CEO Sue Decker talked it up.
As far as the company goes, at a reasonable valuation, I think it's one I'd put away for my kids. I'm a Baba Bull.
A Baba Bull. And as we speak today, that opening price going up and up and up. And the head of Alibaba, Jack Ma, saying they want to be bigger than Walmart. More wildfires in California, 111 square miles. Charges of arson in at least one of those fires. Mendocino County resident Eric Collins said it's likely his home and many others destroyed.
I haven't been allowed up there, but you can. It was right there at the top of the hill. I'm pretty sure it's burned down to the foundation.
And Apple rolls out a delete button on the free U2 album they rolled out with the iPhone 6. Not everybody wanted it on their iTunes lineup. So you don't like it? Hit delete. We're looking at a week in the news. Scotland, money for Syrian rebels, Ebola mounts, NFL woes. Nancy Cordes joins us. Congressional correspondent for CBS News, James Kitfield from National Journal is here. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Are you watching those wildfires in California, the flooding in the Southwest? And let me just throw this one in, one more piece of sound here, because here's Dr. Kent Brantley, one of those doctors who got Ebola, came back to the United States, survived, testified before Senate on the Ebola outbreak, said, do not feel safe here on this side of the Atlantic.
It is a fire straight from the pit of hell. We cannot fool ourselves into thinking that the vast moat of the Atlantic Ocean will protect us from the flames of this fire.
Jack, final thoughts on Ebola before we move on here. You hear the man who had it straight from the pit of hell, a little Joe Biden there.
You know, there's been a good deal of complaint, and we heard it even from the head of the World Health Organization about the health infrastructures in these countries, that they just aren't up to it, and why can't they get their acts together and so on. Well, a letter to the editor of the Times the other day from a physician pointed out that one of the reasons they're having such trouble is that the IMF's structural adjustments of the 90s, as they were euphemistically called, in other words, get your deficit down, stop spending on social matters, on health infrastructure, and then you get more foreign investment, and we will give you a loan, that all of that has had its effect on these countries. And so the West has, Western finance has in a way cast its shadow over this whole business.
I don't know. Surely we are seeing they do not have a health infrastructure to deal with one like this. Louis in Lunenburg, Massachusetts. Louis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just quickly, and I hate to even bring this up, but we know that terror attacks on the United States are always a concern, and Ebola infected people who could come over here and to spread the disease through human contact. I mean, it's a frightening thought, but I just wonder if some of the president's motivation, if there isn't some concern about that being used as a weapon of terror.
Louis, I appreciate your call. Nancy Cordes, everything we've heard, at least so far, has said, look, bring it. Nobody wants it here, but if it comes, we have a health system that would quickly cap it, stop it, cut it off. Ebola as a terror weapon, Nancy?
I mean, I suppose that anything is possible, but, you know, whether it comes over here as a terror weapon or whether it comes over here as because someone who has it gets on a plane and flies to the United States, it's dangerous either way. So, I suppose, you know, these days you have to be alert for any possibility. But I think the much greater concern right now is that as this spreads through Africa, that just increases the chances that someone could knowingly or unknowingly bring it to the U.S.
It doesn't have to be a weapon or be made one. It is one. But you can hear in that call a kind of fervor. I mean, word here that next week there are going to be anti-Islamic ads going up on 100 New York City buses and some subway entrances there with the image of American journalist James Foley just before he was beheaded by that executioner, campaign saying, Islam. In Australia, we had this very notable roundup and charges that ISIS sympathizers or more there had planned to grab people off the streets and cut their heads off for the video. James Kitfield, is ISIS getting magnified somehow beyond its real stature in all this, or are these reasonable responses, at least in Australia's case, to what we're seeing?
Oh, I think what Australia did was a very reasonable response. But, you know, on the point of whether ISIS gets blown up, ISIS is very, very savvy about using social media. Those beheadings were sent out for a reason, to terrify people, just like the videos of all the mass executions of the Iraqi captured soldiers. So this is a very internet-savvy, social media-savvy group. They're very threatening. There's more than 2,000 foreign fighters in their ranks, including hundreds of Europeans and Americans with Western passports. As we've seen with Australia, these guys can travel back or radicalize people back in their home countries, and we have to be very much on the lookout for that. I've talked to senior intelligence officials, and they are extremely worried by the fact that they've just lost a grasp of exactly who is flowing to Syria to fight on behalf of these guys and what's going to happen when they come back.
Dave in Nashville, Tennessee. Dave, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
After following such weighty topics, I feel a little bit silly calling in to discuss the NFL.
It's not marginal this week. What do you think about everything that's going on there, Dave?
Well, being a former player, I played here for the Tennessee Titans for a number of years. What I see is a media-driven circus or a media-driven tsunami of quote-unquote scandal, which is unfortunately gender-based. It seems to be a politically driven agenda, and that it's gender-based because we're not discussing violence. We're discussing specifically male-on-female violence, and we have greatly failed to have to provide any type of nuance. Whenever I see a monolithic thought process or a complete failure to have any plurality of thought, I'm always worried. And that's what I see here. There seems to be only one correct way to think about this subject. No dissenting voices are allowed to speak, not even to present any type of perspective whatsoever.
Dave, I'm really glad you've called. So you played pro ball for what team? What teams?
The Tennessee Titans and then the New York Jets for 2 years. The Tennessee Titans were begin my career and then the New York Jets.
So you've been inside. I mean, now that we've got you, what do you think about the NFL being sort of held up as this, I don't know, petri dish for figuring out our domestic affairs in this country? Is it absolutely, the right thing to do because these are such visible people and these are big issues in the country, domestic abuse and child abuse? Or is the NFL the wrong place to put the microscope?
Well, it's not that it's the wrong place per se. What I see wrong is that it's the only place where we're putting the microscope. If you look at the actual numbers and figures, just look and see how many quote-unquote abusers are found in police departments. Look and see how many quote-unquote abuse cases are found in the political realm. If you look at any spectrum of society, you will find cases where abuse happens because it happens in society. It's a human problem.
Dave, you've been inside here. Stick with us for a second. I want to play a little sound here, Dave, and stick with us from Nashville. This is tape of the came out after the Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson was indicted. And former Minnesota Viking Chris Carter, he's been talking out a lot. Listen here to how he's criticizing corporal punishment in particular and saying NFL players must learn and getting them off the field is the way to teach that.
Take them off the dang on field, because you know what? As a man, that's the only thing we really respect. We don't respect no women. We don't respect no kids. Take them off the field, because they respect that.
Dave, in Nashville, there's another former NFL player. So are you. What do you think of Chris Carter's statement there?
Well, I think that Chris Carter, I was very disappointed in Chris Carter. Chris Carter was a player. If you go back and look at Chris Carter's history when he was a player, I'm not going to castigate Chris Carter here on the air, but I invite all your listeners just to go back and look at Chris Carter's performance as a person, his behavior as a person when he was a player, and ask yourself, does that jive with what you're hearing from him now? I think Chris Carter has become a puppet of the NFL. He's an employee of the NFL. He has begun to toe the company line. As I said, there's monolithic thought on the subject. What Chris Carter is discussing, throwing his mother under the bus that way, I'm not going to do that to Chris Carter, but it's very saddening that people who used to stand for something, who used to look for themselves, you know, as individuals, now become part of a corporate. Again, I say I use the word tsunami of monolithic thought to basically try to force change. It's not about teaching people about violence. It's not about teaching people about the proper way to, quote unquote, be a man. It's about enforcing a way of thought.
Dave, we've got it. And that's from somebody who was in the NFL. A lot of people on the outside watching this and saying, I'm sorry, but no, we've got to use these as moments to sort of lay down a line here. But it's interesting to hear what you've got to say on it, Dave. Anne in David City, Nebraska. Anne, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. How are you doing?
Okay. What do you think, Anne?
Well, I watch football. I'm a woman. I watch football.
Yep.
But I don't. I think it's wrong for these men to fight these women, to fight the kids. They're not role models. Little kids go to those football games and they watch these guys on the field, and then they hear about them hitting the women, hitting the kids. That's not right.
So you say toss them out.
Toss them out. Make an example of them. Don't let them sit on the bench for one or two games and then come back in. That's not right. They're paid too much money to do what they do.
And we've got it. And the NFL thinking about a lot of women like you who watch football and are not happy with what they're hearing and seeing. Austin, Texas. Andrew's calling. Andrew, you're on.
Hi, Tom. To kind of piggyback on what Ann was saying, I think the bigger issue here is that, you know, as an NFL fan myself, you know, who is also a father, it's for us to teach our kids not to idolize NFL players or musicians or anyone that is in the limelight or is famous, because we have to respect and enjoy them for what they do, but not as who they are as individuals, because we don't know them as individuals. We don't personally know them.
Well, I mean, you can see right on the video, you can see in the photographs at least one aspect of a few of these guys. We begin to know them, and what we've learned here has got people pretty upset. Wow. It's just amazing how the NFL has become the looking glass here for the whole country. One more. Ashley, Moore, Oklahoma. Ashley, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to bring up a subject that I think isn't being talked about enough, and that's the point that we're all human, and we all have these emotions of anger and passion, and while that doesn't justify any of these situations, we as a whole need to realize that we are not, you know, judge and jury. We need to remind ourselves that, you know, maybe we've made mistakes that we're embarrassed about or would change differently about ourselves. And we're putting a lot of other people under the microscope, and it's getting to where it feels a little righteous, like people are forgetting that we are human. We're not robots.
Yeah, well, we could all look in the mirror a little bit. We've got it, Ashley, and I appreciate your call from Moore. Nancy Cordes, what do you think about this? I don't know what it is. Teaching moment, punishment moment, both that we're seeing in the NFL.
Well, I think anytime you're famous and paid millions of dollars and in the public eye, you have to know that you're going to be held up as a model, either good or bad. And when something really explosive like this happens, it's going to spark a conversation. And, you know, I think it's a good thing. I think it's the same thing when politicians do something illegal, when members of the media or other celebrities behave badly. This conversation has to start somewhere. And it doesn't mean that you have to demonize one particular group or ostracize them. But you know, this is how these national conversations get started. This is how you come to pay more attention to an issue that probably wasn't getting enough attention. So I think it's a really good thing.
Talk about a national conversation. There will be another one, and it's already starting, I guess. 2016 is coming. Hillary Clinton and others. Joe Biden out in Iowa this week at Tom Harkin's Steak Fry. We've had Chris Christie up in New Hampshire. But Hillary Clinton in Iowa, that's got a certain ring to it. Here she was. I think we'll hear more of this tape before the whole thing is over.
Hello, Iowa. I'm back.
Jack, I don't know if that's the one she wants as her signature return clip, but there it is. What about Hillary Clinton back on the stump? Hasn't claimed that she's in, but boy, she's out.
She's out, and she's defining the current election as a choice between, quote, the guardians of gridlock and the champions of shared opportunity and shared prosperity, without, as people pointing out, saying how she would do any better at managing the obstructionist Congress. You know, I was struck with the role of Bill Clinton at the Steak Fry. He held forth after Hillary had left with a long, garrulous back and forth with the press. And it, you know, we're watching this documentary on the Roosevelts. It reminded me of a comment about Teddy Roosevelt, and it could apply to Bill Clinton. It was said of Teddy that he wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. Well, there's Bill Clinton.
What do you think, Nancy? Is Bill a net plus for Hillary Clinton as she pulls out of the garage here?
So it was interesting. I was standing right there as he was holding forth.
Yeah.
And first of all, I thought it was surprising that she came out and chatted with the 200 or so members of the press that were standing there at all. At
Why is that surprising?
Well, because, you know, it hasn't been her instinct in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that they did come out and chat was telling about the fact that maybe she's trying to change that a little bit. And she spoke for a while. She obviously, you know, she didn't tell us what we really wanted to know. I asked her if being out in Iowa is whetting her appetite for another campaign. She said, oh, she's just here to support Democrats. After a while, she had to go back inside because, you know, it was just one reporter after the other saying, are you going to run for president? Are you going to run for president? So there's only so long that you can kind of stand there and take that question before you have to take your leave. And President Clinton did stay for longer, but he was mostly talking about Tom Harkin, who is retiring, and this is the Harkin steak fry. So he was there with his arm around Tom Harkin, and they were chatting for a little while. But I did think that that President Clinton was remarkably restrained on the stump. He gave a speech after she did. He did not try to overshadow her. He kept it brief, relatively. She was clearly the star of the day, and she looked an awful lot like a candidate. She was posing for photo ops. She was on the rope line for a long time, shaking hands, taking selfies. She looked like someone who was gearing up for a run.
Bill there, but Hillary Clinton, the story in Iowa. Joe Biden there as well. Watch that space. And Chris Christie up in New Hampshire. More to come there as well. Nancy Cordes with CBS. Thanks so much for being with us today, Nancy.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
James Kitfield at National Journal. Thank you, James.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And Jack, thanks to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.